unless the speaker could make an extremely odd hissing sound. All things considered, I gave it even odds.
10,000, said the voice.
I could have played it a couple of different ways. The kinds of people who get into this sort of deal come in about three general types. Greedy, low-life sons of bitches, cold professionals engaged in a business transaction, and desperate amateurs who are in over their heads. I'd already decided to try to come across as the first on the list. 40,000, I shot back instantly. Each. There was a furious sound on the other end of the phone. It wasn't a human sound, either.
I could pluck out your eyes and cut your tongue into slivers, hissed the voice.
Something about it scared the hell out of me, touching on some instinctual level that Ray, in all his repulsive mass, had not. I felt myself shudder, despite my effort not to do so. Whatever, I said, trying to sound bored. Even if you could do it, it gets you nothing. But hey, no skin off my ass either way. There was a long silence on the other end of my phone. I thought I felt some kind of pressure building behind my eyelids. I told myself it was my imagination. Yo, anyone there? I complained. Listen, are you up for doing some business, or did I just waste my time? After another pause, the voice hissed something in a bubbling, serpentine tongue. The phone rustled as if changing hands, and a very deep male voice said,
20,000 each.
I'm not selling the female for less than 30.
50 total, then,
rumbled the new voice. It sounded entirely human. Cash, I demanded.
Done.
I kept tracking the street with my eyes, looking for their spotter, but saw no one. How do you handle delivery?
There's a warehouse.
Fat chance. I pull in there, you just pop me and make the body disappear along with the freaks.
What do you suggest?
Rumbled the voice. Buttercup Park, 30 minutes, one carrier. Carrier hands me half the cash, then carrier verifies the merchandise in the back of my truck. Carrier hands me the rest of the money, I hand him the keys to the vehicle carrying the merchandise. We all walk away happy. The deep-voiced man thought about it for a moment and then grunted. Translation, agreed.
How will you identify me?
I snorted and said, Park isn't huge, tough guy, and it ain't my first rodeo. I hung up on him, then went back to my motorcycle and left, heading for Buttercup Park. A lighted sign hanging outside a bank told me it was 9:15. The metro traffic grid was dying down for the night. I got there in a little more than 15 minutes, parked my Harley in a garage, and made my way to where George's high-dollar SUV was waiting in the same structure. I went around to the back and opened the hatch. Will was just finishing wrapping Marcy in what appeared to be several layers of duct tape, covering her in a swath from her hips to her deltoids, trapping her arms against her sides. She was wearing a simple sundress with, I assumed, nothing underneath. I guess when you change into a wolf, you don't take your ensemble with you. Being trapped in undies made for a different species could prove awkward in a fight. Will looked up and gave me a quick nod of greeting. All set? So far. You're sure we won't have any problem getting out? I asked. Will snorted.
Claws, fangs. It'll sting a bit when it tears out the hair. Nothing serious.
Spoken like someone who's never had his legs waxed, Marcy said in a nervous, forcedly jovial tone. She might have looked like a skinny little thing, but the muscles showing on her legs were lean and ropey. Will tore off the end of the duct tape and passed the roll to me. He sat down on the open floor in the back of the SUV, the seats of which had been folded away to make room for the prisoners. He stripped out of his shirt, leaving only a pair of loose sweats. I started wrapping him. Tighten your muscles, I said. When I'm done, relax them. It should leave you enough room to maintain blood flow.
Right, Will said. Houdini.
He contracted the muscles in his upper body and the duct tape creaked.
Damn, the kid was built.
Given that I was more or less leaning against his naked back to reach around him with the roll of tape, it was impossible not to notice. Dresden hadn't been muscled as heavily as Will. Harriet had a runner's build, all lean, tight, dense muscle that... I clenched my jaw and kept wrapping tape. One more time, I said. I meet the contact, then bring him here. I held up the SUV's remote control fob. I'll disarm the security system so you'll know we're coming. If you hear me say the word red, it means things aren't going well.
Get loose and help me jump the contact. We'll question him, find out where the other specials are being kept. Otherwise, sit tight and make like you got hit with tranquilizer darts. I'll shadow you back to their HQ. What then? Marcy asked. We'll have to play that by ear, I said. If there aren't many of them, we'll hit them and get your people out. If they've got a lot of muscle, I'll make a call. If I can get a large force here, they'll run rather than fight. Can you be sure of that? Will asked. Dresden said that to the supernatural world, bringing in mortal authorities was equated with nuclear exchanges. No one wants to be the one to trigger a new inquisition of some kind, so any group with a sense of reason will cut their losses rather than tangle with the cops. The way they didn't tangle with the FBI headquarters? Will asked. I had sort of hoped no one would notice that flaw in my reasoning. That was an act of war. This is some kind of profit-gaining scheme. Come on, Karen, Will said. You've got to know better than that. This is a professional operation, I said. Whoever is behind it is depending on distraction and speed to enable them to get away with it. They'll already have their escape plan ready to go. If a bunch of cars and lights come at them, I think their first instinct will be to run rather than fight. Yeah, Marcy said, nodding. That makes sense. You've always said supernatural predators don't want to fight if they can avoid one, Will. Lone predators don't, Will said. But this is an organization. And you might have noticed how a lot of supernatural types are a couple of French fries short of a happy meal. And I'm talking about more than here tonight. More than Georgia and Andy. More than just Chicago. I frowned at him. What do you mean? He leaned forward, his eyes intent. I mean that if Dresden just blew up the Red Court, that means the status quo is gone. There's a power vacuum, and every spook out there is going to try to fill it. The rules have changed. We don't know how these people are going to react. A sobering silence fell over us. I hadn't followed the line of reasoning like Will had. Or rather, I hadn't followed it far enough. I'd only been thinking of Dresden's cataclysm in terms of its effect on my city, upon people who were part of my life. But he was right. Dear God, he was right. The sudden demise of the Red Court, with consequences that would reach around the whole world, would make the fall of the Soviet Union look like a minor organizational crisis. So what? I asked. We back out? Are you kidding? Will said. They took my wife. We go get her and anyone else they've taken. Right, Marcy said firmly from where she lay on the bed of the vehicle. I felt a smile bare my teeth. And if they fight? Will's face hardened. Then we kick their fucking ass. Ass, said Marcy, nodding. I finished wrapping Will in the duct tape. He exhaled slowly and relaxed. He took a few experimental breaths and then nodded. Okay, good. Lie down, both of you. I'll be back with the buyer. Be careful, Will said. If you aren't back in 20 minutes, I'll come looking. If I'm not back in 20 minutes, there won't be much point in finding me, I said. Then I shut them into the SUV and headed for the park. Buttercup Park wasn't exactly overwhelming. There were grass, playground equipment, and a tree or two on an island bordered by 4 city streets. That was pretty much it. It was the sort of place my low-life persona would choose. It was out in the open, and there was not much to break up the line of sight. It was a good location for criminals with mutual trust issues to meet up. Each could be sure the other was alone. Each could be reasonably sure the other wouldn't start shooting right out there in front of God and everybody. The park, as it should have been, was empty. The surrounding streetlights left little hidden on the green grass, but the playground equipment cast long, asymmetric shadows. A man sat on one of the swings. He was huge, the biggest individual I'd ever seen. He was heavy with muscle, though it was an athlete's balanced build, made for action, not for display. His hips strained the heavy, flexible plastic seat of the swing to the horizontal. He must have been better than 7 feet tall. He was quietly sitting there, completely still, watching and waiting. His head was shaved and his skin was dark. He wore a simple outfit, black chinos and a thin turtleneck sweater. If the October chill was bothering him, it didn't show. I stomped over to him in my Munster boots. When I was about 30 feet away, he turned his head toward me. His gaze was startling. His eyes were blue-white, as on some northern sled dogs, and looked nearly luminous in the half-shadows. He lifted his eyebrows as I came closer, then rose and bowed politely from the waist. I realized that he wasn't 7 feet tall. He was more like 7'4" or 5". "Good evening," he said. His basso rumble was unmistakable. This was the person I had spoken to earlier. I stopped in front of him and put a hand on my hip, eyeing him as if I wasn't much impressed. "As long as you brought the money, it will be," I drawled. He reached into a cavernous pocket in his pants and drew out a brick wrapped in plastic. He tossed it to me. "Half." I caught it and tore open the plastic with my teeth. Then I started counting the money, all of it in non-sequential Ben Franklin's. A trace of impatience entered my contact's voice. "It's all there." "Talking to me is just going to make me lose count and start over," I said. "What am I supposed to call you?"
"Nothing," he said. "No one. I'm nothing to you."
"Nothing it is," I replied. The bills were bound in groups of 50. I counted one out and compared its thickness to that of the others, then flipped through just to be sure Nothing wasn't trying to short me by throwing some 20s into the middle of the stack. Then I stuck the money in my jacket pocket and said, "We're in business." Nothing inclined his head a bit.
"The merchandise?"
"Come with me," I said, injecting my voice with breezy confidence. I turned to stomp back toward the garage parking lot, and Nothing paced along beside me. Already this wasn't going well. This guy was huge. I was good, but training and practice can only get you so far. The old saying is that a good big man will beat a good little man, which is sexist as all get out, but no less true. Levels of skill being equal, whoever has the size and weight advantage damn near always wins. Nothing probably outweighed all three of us together, and I already had a sense from the way he held himself and moved that he was a person accustomed to violence. He was good. I could shoot him, probably, but I didn't need a dead trafficker on my hands. I needed one who could talk, which meant I was going to have to let Will and Marcy be taken. "How long you fellas setting up shop?" I asked him as we walked. "Might be able to come up with another one if the price is right." Nothing looked at me for a moment before speaking.
"If you cannot do it by dawn, do not bother."
"Maybe. We'll see how this plays out." Nothing shrugged and kept on walking. I caught sight of our reflection in the passing window, Biker Barbie and Bigfoot. I tried to keep out of his reach as we walked, but there was only so much sidewalk, and Nothing's arms looked long enough to slap me from the middle of the street. As we walked, I noticed the smell. The man just smelled wrong. I wasn't sure what it was, something musty, vaguely like the scent of stagnant water and rotting fish. It hung in the air around him. "You aren't really human, are you?" I noted as we walked into the parking garage and away from any potential witnesses.
"Not anymore," he replied.
As he spoke, the collar of the turtleneck stirred. It rippled as if something had moved beneath it. "Well, I am," I said, "completely worthless for whatever you're doing collecting specials, so don't be thinking you can get 3 for the price of 2. Nothing looked down at me with those unsettling eyes.
"You are pathetic."
I put a little extra swagger into my step.
"Careful what you say there, big guy. You'll turn me on."
Nothing made a small, quiet sound of disgust and shook his head. It was hard not to smile as I watched him pigeonhole me into scum, treacherous, decadent. "It's right up here."
"Before we approach the vehicle," he said, "you should know that if you have associates waiting in ambuscade, I will break their necks and yours."
I lifted my hands.
"Jesus, show a little trust, will you? We're all capitalists here."
I pointed the fob at the SUV and disarmed the alarm with a little electronic chirp. The lights flashed once. I tossed him the keys.
"That one. I'll stay back here if you like."
"Acceptable,"
he said, and strode to the SUV. Watching him bend down to look in was like a scene from Jurassic Park. He opened the rear hatch and then lifted his hands to his neck for a moment. He tugged the turtleneck down a little. The skin of Nothing's neck was deformed with narrow flaps of skin somehow, and it took me a few seconds to realize what I was looking at. Gills. The man had gills, and he was breathing through them. They opened and closed in a rhythm not far removed from a dog's sniffing.
"Werewolves," he said. "Valuable."
"They make good pets?" I asked.
He reached in and seized Will, lifting him with one hand. The young man remained limp, his eyes closed.
Their blood has unique properties. What did you use to subdue them?
Roofies. The way my dating life has been going, I keep some on hand. He made a dissatisfied sound and tugged his collar up again.
The drug might lower their value.
I hope not, I said. This has been such a nice conversation, I'd hate for it to end in a gunshot. Nothing turned his head slightly and gave me a very cold little smile. I felt threatened enough to produce my gun without even consciously thinking about it. I held it in two hands, pointed at the ground near his feet. We stayed that way, facing off for several seconds. Then he shrugged a shoulder. He produced another brick of bills and threw it to me, along with the truck keys. Then he gathered up Marcy and tossed her over one shoulder, and Will over the other. He turned to the entrance of the garage and made several sharp popping clicks as he went, producing, with an odd quiver of his chest and throat, a sound that was somehow familiar. They must have been a signal. A moment later, a van with rental agency plates pulled up to the curb and stopped. A man dressed identically to Nothing rolled open the side door. Nothing put the two werewolves inside, then followed them, somehow compressing his bulk enough to get into the van. The driver pulled back into traffic a second later. The entire pickup had taken less than 10 seconds. I got back onto my motorcycle and rolled out of the garage with my lights off before their van had gotten to the end of the block. Then, settling in to follow them from several car lengths back, I tried to make like a hole in the air. Nothing and his driver headed for the docks, which was hardly unanticipated. Chicago supports an enormous amount of shipping traffic that travels through the Great Lakes and offloads cargo to be transferred to railroads or trucking companies for shipment throughout the United States. Such ships remain one of the best means for moving illegal goods without being discovered. There are plenty of storage buildings down by the docks, and Nothing went to one of the seedier, more run-down warehouses on the waterfront. I noted the location and went on by without stopping. Then I circled around, killed the engine, with the bike still in motion, and came coasting back over the cracked old asphalt, the whisper of my tires lost in the susurrus of city sounds and water lapping the lakeshore. There wasn't much to see. The warehouse had a single set of standard doors and several large steel doors that would roll up to allow crates and shipping containers to be brought inside. They were all closed. A single guard, a man in a watch cap and a squall coat, wandered aimlessly around outside the building, smoking cigarettes and looking bored. I got rid of the damn clunky Munster boots and pulled on the black slippers I always wore on the practice mat. I pulled weapons and gear out of the bike's saddlebags, attached the items to the tactical harness under my coat, and slipped closer. I stayed where it was dark, using the shadows to hide my approach. Then I found a particularly deep patch of darkness and waited. It took a seemingly endless 5 minutes for the guard to get close enough for me to shoot him with a taser. Darts leapt out and plunged into his chest, trailing shining wires, and I pulled the trigger while he jerked and twitched and fell to the ground. I wasn't sure if this guy was human or not, but I wasn't taking chances. I kept the juice on him until I was sure he was down for the count. When I let up, he just lay there on his side, curled up halfway into a fetal position, quivering and twitching while drool rolled out of his mouth. Actually, he sort of reminded me of my second husband in the morning. I jerked the darts out of him and shoved the taser and the trailing wire into my jacket pocket. It would take too much time to reset it for use, and I had a bad feeling that the electronic device wouldn't do me much good inside the warehouse. I could have slapped some heavy restraining ties on him, but I would be happier if anyone who found the downed man had no idea what had happened to him. So much for the easy part. My P90 hung easily from the tack harness, its stock high, its barrel hanging down the line of my body. I took a moment to screw a suppressor onto the end of the gun and lifted it into firing position against my shoulder. The little Belgian assault weapon was illegal for a civilian to own within city limits. The suppressor, too. If I got caught with them, I'd be in trouble. If I got caught using them, I'd do time. Both of those consequences were subordinate to the fact that if I didn't go in armed for bear, I might not live to congratulate myself on my sterling citizenship. Well, there's no such thing as a perfect solution, is there? I moved quietly back to the entry door, silenced weapon tight against my shoulder. I duck-walked, my steps quick and small and rolling, to keep my upper body level as it moved.
I'd put a red dot sight on the P-90, and it floated in my vision as a translucent crosshair of red light. The sight made the weapon, to some degree, point and click. The idea was for the bullets to go wherever the crosshairs were centered. I had it sighted for short work. Even though I'd seen more action than practically any cop in the country, thanks to Dresden, I could count on one hand the number of times I'd used a weapon in earnest against a target more than 7 or 8 yards away. Standing next to the entry door, I tested the knob. It turned freely. So the folks inside had been relying on their guard to keep intruders out. I thought of the first hissing voice I'd spoken to on the phone and shivered. They wouldn't be relying on purely physical defenses. But I knew something about those, too. Harry's defenses had been deadly dangerous. But to create them, apparently you had to use the energy of a threshold, which only grew up around an actual home. This old warehouse was a place of business, and it didn't have a threshold. So if a spell had been put up to guard the door, it would have to be fairly weak. Of course, weak was a relative term in Dresden's vocabulary. It might only hit me hard enough to break bones, instead of disintegrating me completely, if there was a spell there at all. I hated this magic crap. Screw it. I couldn't just stand here all night. I turned the doorknob slowly, keeping my body as far to one side as possible. Then I pushed in gently, and the door swung open by an inch or three. When nothing exploded or burst into wails of alarm, I eased up next to it and peeked into the building. It was like looking into another world. Green and blue light crawled and slithered up the walls and over the warehouse's interior, eerie and subtly unsettling, each color moving in waves of differing widths and speeds. The strange scent of water and fish was strong inside. There were things on the wall. Growths was all I could call them. Ugly patches of some kind of lumpy, rough substance I didn't recognize were clumped all around the walls and ceiling of the warehouse in roughly circular patches about 6 feet across. Cages were scattered all around the floor, a bunch of 5-foot cubes made of heavy steel grid. People were locked up in several of them, the doors held shut by heavy chains. Most of them just sat, staring at nothing, or lay upon their sides doing the same thing, completely motionless. That wasn't normal. Even someone who was drugged but conscious would show a little more animation than that. This meant magic was involved, some kind of invasive mental stuff, and a little voice in my head started screaming. I've been subjected to that kind of invasion more than once. It's bad. My legs felt weak, my hands shook. The rippling colors of light on the walls became something sinister, disorienting, the beginnings of another attack on my mind. Jesus Christ. I wanted to turn around and scurry away, as swiftly and as meekly as possible. In fact, I tried to. My legs quivered as if preparing to move, but the motion drew my gaze across another row of cages, and I saw Georgia. She was naked, kneeling, her hands wrapped gently around her swelling stomach, cradling her unborn child. Her head was bowed in a posture of meekness, and her sleek shoulders and neck were relaxed. But I saw her eyes, open and staring at the bottom of the cage, and I saw the defiance flickering in them. Whatever held the others held Georgia as well, but she evidently had not been subdued as readily as they had. She was still fighting them. Something deep inside me, something hard and fierce and furious, locked my legs into place. I stared at Georgia, and I knew I couldn't run. I remembered that Will and Marcy were in there, waiting for me to announce that the moment was right to change form and fight. I remembered that nearly all of those people in the cages were young, even younger than the werewolves, including the youngest of all, in George's cage. I remembered blood, splattered on the weathered cabin of a boat, and that there was no one but me coming to help those kids. The fear changed form on me. It disguised itself as reason. "Don't go in," it told me. "Know your limits. Send for help." But the only serious help I could get would be S.I., and they would be putting their own careers, as well as their lives, on the line if they came to my aid. I could send for the regular police, drop in an anonymous call, but in this part of town it might take half an hour for them to show up. Even when they did arrive, they'd be lambs to the slaughter.
Most of the force had no idea what really went on in the city's darkest shadows.
"You could go get the sword," said my fear. "You know where it is. You know how strong it makes you."
Not many people could honestly say they've wielded a magic sword against the forces of darkness, but I'm one of them. Fidelacius, the sword of faith, lay waiting for the hand of someone worthy to wield it against the powers of darkness. In the final battle with the Red Court, that hand had been mine. In the darkest moment of that fight, when all seemed lost, it had been my hand upon Fidelacius that had tipped the balance, enabling Dresden to prevail. And I had felt a power greater than I supporting me, guiding my movements, and for a single, swift moment, entering into me and making use of my lips and tongue to pronounce sentence upon the murderous creatures surrounding us. I could go for the sword. Odds were it would be of some help. But I knew that if I did, I would have taken the easy path. I would have turned away from a source of terror for the most excellent rational of reasons, and the next time I faced the same kind of fear, it would be a little easier to turn away, a little easier to find good reasons not to act. The sword was a source of incredible power, but it was nothing but cool, motionless steel without the hand that could grip it, the muscles that would move it, the eyes and the mind that would guide it. Without them, the sword was nothing. I stopped and stared down at my shaking hand. Without my hand, my mind, my will, the sword was nothing. And if that was true, then it must also be true that my hand was what mattered, that it had been my hand, my will, that had made the difference. And my hand was right here. In fact, I had two of them. My breathing steadied and slowed. Sword or no sword, I had sworn to serve and protect the people of the city. And if I turned away from that oath now, if I gave in to my fear, even for the most seductively logical of reasons, then I had no right to take up the sword of faith in any case. My hand stopped shaking and my breathing slowed and steadied, bringing the terror under control. I whispered a quick, almost entirely mental prayer to St. Jude, the patron of lost causes and policemen. It sounded something like, "Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, help!" I nudged the door open a few more inches, then slid into the warehouse, moving with as much speed and silence as I possessed, my gun at the level and ready. I moved down the length of the warehouse, mostly hidden behind a shelving unit more than 20 feet high. It was stacked with pallets, loading gear, storage bins, and the occasional barrel or box of unknown provenance. The shifting, constantly wavering light made an excellent cover for motion, and I timed my steps to move in rhythm with the dancing illumination. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up, and it felt like every inch of my skin was covered in goose flesh. I'd been in the presence of dangerous magic often enough to know the feeling of dark power in motion. It had been like this at Chichen Itza, and in the waters off the island of Demon Reach, and in the Wraith Deeps, and at Arctis Tor, and in the nest of Black Court vampires, and at... You get the point. This wasn't my first rodeo. The most important thing would be to take out Nothing's presumptive boss, and fast, preferably before anyone knew I was here at all. The warehouse reeked of magic, and if a mortal goes into a fair fight against a wizard, the mortal loses. Period. They have power that is literally almost unimaginable, and if the bad guy got a chance to defend himself, the only uncertainty remaining would be how much creativity he put into killing me. At the end of the shelving unit there was a rolling ladder, one made to run all the way up and down the shelves and provide easy access. The warehouse was darker up near the ceiling than at floor level. I didn't even slow down. I went up the ladder to the top of the shelving unit and froze in place, getting a good, clear look at the enemy for the first time. There were half a dozen of them, including Nothing, and they all shopped at the same store. Their outfits were conspicuous due to their uniformity, though some instinct made me think they had been intended as disguises. That individuality as a concept wasn't of any particular concern to Nothing and his crew. Nothing was, by far, the largest of the men, though none of them looked like featherweights. They were loading cages into a railroad cargo container, a fairly common sight on large ships, some of which could carry hundreds of the metal boxes. The cages had been sized to stack exactly into the railroad car,
two across and three high, with no consideration whatsoever for the human cargo. There were no blankets, no pads, nothing but metal cages and vulnerable skin. I spotted Andy's cage not far from George's. The red-headed girl had evidently lacked some critical capacity to resist whatever had been done to her. She lay on her back, staring blankly up at the roof of her cage. The werewolf girl was a bombshell. Even lying in completely passive relaxation, her curves beckoned the eye, but the hollow despair of her expression was haunting. Nothing was standing over Will and Marcy, who lay limp and motionless on the floor at his feet. A couple of turtlenecks were hauling an empty cage toward them.
"How long will it take?" he was asking a third man.
"Without knowing the exact drug, several hours," the man replied.
His voice was plainly human and sounded nothing like whoever it was I'd spoken to on the phone.
"Perhaps more."
Nothing frowned.
"Can you make a determination of their viability by dawn?"
"If I am able to isolate the substance that incapacitated them before then," he said. "I have no means of determining how many attempts will be required. It will take as long as it takes."
"He will not be pleased,"
Nothing said.
The man bowed his head. "My life for the master. I will do all in my power to serve him. Should he be disappointed in me, it is meet for him to take my life."
Nothing nodded.
"Be about it."
The man turned and walked quickly away, holding two small vials of rich red blood in his hand. Samples from Will and Marcy, I assumed. By then, the empty cage had arrived. Nothing picked up Marcy and lifted her toward the waiting cage. I bit down on a curse. If I let him imprison her, a full third of my team would be neutralized, as helpless as the prisoners who had already been taken. But if I started the music early, I risked throwing away my sucker punch. Nothing's master might show up at any time. On the other hand, Nothing seemed to be large and in charge. Perhaps the hissing person I'd spoken to on the phone had left matters in Nothing's shovel-like hands. Or perhaps I'd read the situation incorrectly. What if one of the other turtlenecks had been the first speaker and Nothing was really the boss? I made up my mind and settled a P-90's crosshair onto Nothing's head, a little below the tip of his nose. The weapon was set for automatic fire, and while I could control the weapon fairly well, especially when it was loaded with subsonic rounds, the recoil would tend to carry the weapon's muzzle higher after the first shot. Against anything human, more than one round to the head would be overkill. When the merely mortal goes up against the supernatural, there's no such thing as overkill. I snuggled the gun in close and tight, took a deep breath in, let it halfway out, held it, and began slowly to squeeze the weapon's trigger. The instant before the trigger would have broken, there was a shimmering in the air, and a man stepped out of it, appearing as if from nowhere. I backed off the tension on my finger, feeling my heart surge with unspent adrenaline. The man was of medium height, with sallow skin and greasy, straight black hair that hung past his shoulders. His lips were very thick and his mouth very wide, almost to the point of deformity. His large eyes were dark and watery and bulging, his nose sunken, as small as any I'd ever seen. He was soaking wet and naked, his limbs scrawny and long, his hands very, very wide. Except for the hair, I couldn't help but compare him to a frog, a sullen, vicious frog. The man let out a sound somewhat like a muffled belch, then vomited water onto the floor. Flaps of skin at his neck flared in and out, spewing smaller sprays of water several times until he drew in a breath through his mouth, evidently filling his lungs with air. All of the turtlenecks turned to face the creature and fell to their knees, including Nothing, who calmly set Marcy aside and went into a full kowtow, his palms flat on the floor, his forehead pressed down onto his knuckles.
"So," he hissed, "did the insolent creature deliver our prizes?"
I recognized the voice from the telephone.
"Yes, my lord,"
rumbled Nothing.
"As promised, and in plenty of time to move."
"Did you strike the bitch down?"
Nothing rocked back and then bowed again, somehow giving the impression that he was doing it more deeply.
"She was clever enough to build safeguards into the meeting. I could not do so without attracting attention.
Frogface hissed.
I will settle with the mortal another time, he said. Such insolence cannot be countenanced.
No, my lord.
Bring the new acquisitions. I will bind them.
They have been given drugs, my lord. The binding could damage them.
Without looking particularly excited about it, Frogface kicked Nothing in the armpit. The blow was a more powerful one than Frogface's frame would suggest he was capable of giving. It flung Nothing from his hands and knees and onto his side by main force.
Bring them.
I obey,
wheezed Nothing. He rose unsteadily and went to pick up Will. He dropped the young werewolf onto the floor beside Marcy.
Such disgusting things, mortals.
Frogface murmured, his eyes lifted to Georgia in her cage.
She has not yet capitulated.
No, my lord, Nothing muttered.
Interesting.
Frogface said, and a leer spread over his broad mouth.
When we arrive, transport her to my chambers. We will see what is left of her strength when the spawn is taken from her womb.
Jesus, men can be assholes, even when they're barely human. Frogface was officially elected. Georgia shuddered. She lifted her head very slowly, as if it had been held down with vast weights. And the glare she turned on Frogface was nothing less than murderous. Frogface chuckled at the expression and turned to face Will and Marcy. He dipped his fingers into a pouch that hung around his neck, almost invisible against his leathery skin, and withdrew what looked like a small seashell from it. He leered at the motionless Marcy and said,
"First, the female."
He closed his eyes and made a low sound in his throat. Then began chanting words that bubbled and gobbled out from between his rubbery lips.
Now I've got you,
I thought to myself, and sighted the gun on Frogface's rubbery lips. I didn't have Dresden's knowledge of magic, but I knew any wizard was vulnerable when they began working forces, the way Frogface was doing. The concentration needed was intense. If I'd understood Dresden correctly, it would mean that Frogface would have to be focusing his entire attention on his spell, leaving nothing remaining for defending his sallow hide. The air began to shimmer around Frogface's hands, and fine, slithering tendrils emerged from the brightly colored shell and began to drift down toward Marcy, a cloud of tendrils as fine as a cobweb. Certain now of my target, I breathed, held it, and squeezed the trigger. Say what you like about the Belgians, they can make some fine weaponry. The silenced P-90 barely whispered when the burst of automatic fire erupted from the end of the suppressor. There was no flash, no thunder, just a soft wheezing sound and the click of the gun's action cycling. Thanks to the subsonic ammunition, the discharge itself actually made less noise than the round striking Frogface's skull. There were several wet, loud, cracking sounds, and every one of the rounds I'd fired struck home. One round would have been messy enough. When half a dozen of them hit, Frogface's head quite literally exploded, shattered to pulp and shards of bone by the bullet's impact, and two-thirds of his skull, from the upper lip on up, simply vanished into green-blooded spray. There was a flash of angry red light from the seashell. Frogface let out a high-pitched tinny scream, and the near-headless body began to topple, thrashing wildly. The turtlenecks all came to their feet, looking around in wide-eyed confusion. My weapon had given them absolutely no clue as to where the attack had come from. I sighted in on nothing, but from my angle, any rounds that went through him would threaten Will and the caged prisoner beyond him. I shifted targets, settling the red crosshairs on another turtleneck standing just past Will. I squeezed off another whispering burst of a half-dozen or so rounds, and the creature's neck exploded into a cloud of scarlet gore the consistency of mucus. It went limp, settling to the floor like a deflating balloon. Nothing's pale-eyed gaze snapped over toward me, and I saw his gaze track the fall of brass bullet casings from where they bounced off the floor back up to my position on the shelves. He let out an enraged sound, pulled a short tube from his pocket, and pointed it at me. I moved, sliding back down the ladder to the floor, hardly moving more slowly than if I'd fallen.
There was a high-pitched whistle, and something that looked like a small, spiny sea urchin flew past me, just over my head, close enough for the wind of its passage to stir dark-dyed hairs. It slammed into the wall behind me and remained there, quivering, as its spines punched through the metal siding and stuck. Drops of yellow-green liquid fell from the tips of some of the spines and began smoking and eating small holes in the concrete floor. Yikes. Throaty, popping, clicking sounds from several sources filled the air, an exchange of what could only be language. I ran for the far end of the shelving unit as the dark forms of the turtlenecks started moving toward me. I caught glimpses of them between the boxes and containers stacked on the lowest shelf, running with a lithe, floating agility of professional athletes. I ran past a clump of the growth on the wall, a little lower than most, and as I approached, it suddenly fluoresced with bioluminescent color. On sheer instinct, I threw myself flat to the concrete floor and slid past on my belly, as the lumpy growths began hissing and jets of mist, the same color as the fluid covering the urchin spines, began to spray forth at random. The smell was hideous, and I scrambled back to my feet and kept running down the aisle, staying as far from the wall as I could. If I'd been half a step slower, I would have died. There was a great crash, and nothing smashed through the lowest level of the shelving unit, thrusting aside a steel drum and a wooden crate the size of a coffin, as if they'd been made of styrofoam. His fingers missed grabbing onto me by inches. A second turtleneck beat me to the end of the shelf. I opened up with the P-90, praying that a ricochet wouldn't kill one of the prisoners, but my target moved with the speed of a striking serpent, bounding forward to plant a foot against the steel wall of the warehouse, 6 feet off the ground. Using only a single leg, he kicked off into a backflip that carried him back past the end of the shelf and out of my line of fire. The damn thing hadn't been moving fast enough to dodge bullets, but he'd been moving fast enough to dodge me. And I was the one doing the aiming. A round might have clipped one of his legs, but that was all, and nothing was pounding up behind me, gaining despite his mass. I felt like a squirrel being pursued by a German shepherd. If he caught me, it would end about the same way. So I played squirrel, and instead of running in the open, I turned 90 degrees to my right and dove between two stacks of pallets on the lowest shelf. I took a little skin off an arm in hurling myself between them and emerged onto the open warehouse floor. I heard Nothing's shoes squealing on the floor as he applied the brakes behind me. A turtleneck was coming straight at me, on a direct line from the cages not yet loaded into the railroad car. I brought the P-90 up and dropped to one knee. The turtleneck rushed forward, his pale blue eyes wide and staring. He held an inward-curving knife in one hand and carried it low and close to his leg. He knew how to use it. I put the scarlet crosshairs on his sternum and squeezed the trigger. The instant before the shots would have sputtered out of the gun, the turtleneck leapt straight up, flipping once in the air as he went over me. After seeing the incredible quickness of the other not-quite-humans, I'd been waiting for the dodge. As soon as his feet left the floor, I spun to my left, opening fire the instant the end of the barrel was clear of the prisoners. Bullets hissed through the air like a great scythe, and in the edge of my vision, I saw the turtleneck I'd wounded seconds before. He'd come charging toward me while I'd aimed at his buddy, and the sudden turn took him by surprise. There was no aiming involved. It was a brute force approach. I emptied the rest of the clip at him and prayed I could leave him no safe space in which to dodge. St. Jude gets a lot of business, but sometimes he comes through. The hissing, puffing little gun spat out a line of deadly projectiles and intersected the turtleneck's path, tearing a row of 5 or 6 holes across his upper body. The turtleneck screamed and went down. But the one who'd leapt over me dropped back down, adjusting swiftly to the situation, and then whipped the hooked knife across my belly. Almost anyone else in town would have been killed. The knife struck with enormous power, and its blade was sharp. Standard Kevlar-style body armor wouldn't have done a damn thing to stop it. I'd stopped wearing the standard stuff, thanks to one too many exciting outings with Dresden. I wore a double-thickness vest now, and sandwiched between the layers of anti-ballistic fabric was a corselet of tightly linked titanium rings, manufactured for me by one of Dresden's friends, the wife of a retired Fist of God. The knife sliced right through the Kevlar. It split a ring or three, but then the tip caught in the titanium.
Instead of spilling my intestines upon the ground, the superhumanly powerful blow wound up dragging me along and flung me across the concrete floor. I went down into a roll and spread out the force of the fall, coming back up to my feet, already having released the empty magazine from the P-90. I was reaching for the fresh one when another turtleneck abruptly closed in on me from behind and slipped a slim, iron-hard arm around my neck. I barely got a hand inside the loop of his arm before he could lock the choke on me, and I twisted like an eel to get out. His strength was far superior to mine, but then whose wasn't? Even in grappling, strength isn't absolutely everything. The turtleneck might have been faster than I, but I had the advantage of experience. My timing was good enough to let me sense the opening, the lack of pressure in the weakest part of his hold, and I managed to writhe out of his grip, only to have a forearm smash down across my shoulders, driving me to the floor. As I went down, I saw that the turtleneck with the knife was only a few steps away. I'd never escape a pair of them. I didn't have time to get another magazine into the P-90, so I rolled with it and smashed the heavy polymer stock of the weapon into the nearest turtleneck's kneecap. He screamed and seized me by the neck of the leather jacket, shaking me like a doll. At which point, Will and Marcy gave Nothing's companions an object lesson as to why werewolves instill terror in mortal hearts and minds. There was a flash of dark fur, a snarl, a horrible tearing sound, and the turtleneck screamed. He started listing to one side, and I realized that one of the werewolves had just severed the hamstring of the turtleneck's unwounded leg. We both went down. I twisted out of the leather jacket, though I had to drop the P-90 and let it hang from my harness to do it, and rolled free of the turtleneck. An instant later, a second, slightly lighter brown form, teeth gleaming, darted past the fallen turtleneck and ripped out what would have been the jugular vein on a human being. Apparently it was close enough for government work. The turtleneck thrashed in dying agony as mucus-like red blood bubbled from the gaping wound. And suddenly there were two beasts from the nightmares of mankind standing on either side of me, facing the enemy. They were wolves, one large and dark, the other slightly smaller and lighter, but both heavily laden with muscle and thick fur, and their golden eyes burned with awareness and fury. Faced with a pair of murderous werewolves, the knife-wielding turtleneck slid to a sudden, uncertain halt. In the sudden silence that followed, the sound of me slapping a fresh magazine into the P-90 and racking the first round into the chamber was a sharp trio of clicks. Pop, click, clack. "See nothing?" I thought. "I can make ominous noises, too." I brought the weapon back up and snarled, "Lose the knife!" The turtleneck hesitated for half a second, eyes darting left and right, then released it. The steel chimed as the knife hit the floor. I kept the weapon on him, the trigger half pulled. Yeah, it wasn't a safe, smart way to operate, but frankly I wouldn't lose any sleep if I accidentally shot this guy. He was just too damn fast to give up any advantage at all. "There were five of them," I said to the wolves. "How many did you handle, including the one that was on me?" The more lightly colored wolf let out two precise, low barks. "I got two," I said. "That leaves this one and the big guy." A complex sequence of clicks and pops drifted through the air, and the lights went out, plunging the warehouse into perfect darkness. Instinctively, my finger tightened on the trigger, and I sent a burst of rounds out almost before the lights were gone. But I was literally shooting blind against a foe who had supernatural reflexes, and had also known, thanks to those damn clicks, what was about to happen. I heard the rounds hammer through the far wall. The wolves snarled and started forward. The warehouse wasn't a light, tight, dark room, and a wolf's eyes actually see better in near darkness than in full light. The gloom was no obstacle to them, but I seized handfuls of fur and hissed, "Wait!" Their momentum dragged me several inches forward before they slowed down, but I said, "The growths on the wall spray out acid, at least 7 or 8 feet. Don't get suckered in close to one. The big guy has something like a gun. Go." The wolves bounded out from beneath my hands, leaving me alone in the darkness. Clicks and pops continued to bounce around the empty space of the warehouse, impossible for me to localize. They were an ongoing thing every couple of seconds, and I couldn't shake the idea that they were coming closer and closer to me. Even as I crouched there, defenseless and hating it, my hands were scrambling at the pouch on my tack vest.
If there was too much magic running amok, flashlights might not be reliable. Magic screws up technology when there's too much of both of them around, and you don't take chances with something as important as being effectively struck blind. I'd prepared the tack best with this kind of situation in mind. I opened the pouch and pulled out a flare, popping the pull cord, which struck it to life as I did. Red light glared into the darkness, and I lifted the flare over my head and out of my own vision in my left hand. I held the P-90 in my right. The small weapon could be fired in one hand, no problem, and while it wouldn't be as accurate, I could still send bursts downrange almost as well as I could two-handed. The pops and clicks continued, everywhere and nowhere. I had no idea where Will and Marcy were, and Nothing and the other turtleneck had an awful lot of shadow to hide in. I realized I was essentially sitting in the middle of an open floor under a spotlight, a perfect target for Nothing and his weird little urchin gun, and I retreated toward the caged prisoners. "Georgia," I said, crouching down beside her. I studied the door of the cage and found that the thing wasn't even locked. It had a ring for a padlock on it, but the door's mechanism was simply cycled closed. I spun it open and pulled open the cage door. "Georgia, can you move?" She lifted her head and stared at me grimly. Then she turned her body and leaned forward, moving as though underwater, and slowly began to crawl out of the cage. I hurried to Andy's cage and opened that door as well, but the girl did not so much as blink or stir a finger when I urged her to get out. So much for reinforcements. I felt useless. I couldn't go out there into the dark to join Will and Marcy in the hunt. I'd be worse than useless stumbling around out there. They'd be forced to take their attention from their attack in order to protect me.
"Murphy?" Georgia said. "Murphy?"
I hurried to her side. "I'm here. Are you hurt?" She shook her head.
No. Listen."
She lifted her head to meet my eyes, her neck wobbling like a paraplegic's.
"Listen."
Clicks. Pops. Once a hackle-raising snarl. The whishing sound of an urchin flying through the air, and the sharp pong of its hitting a metal exterior wall.
"The guards," Georgia said. "Sonar."
I stared at her for a second, and then clued into what she was talking about. The clicks and pops had sounded familiar because I had heard them before, or something very close to them, from dolphins at the Shedd Aquarium. Dolphins sent out sharp pulses of sound and used them to navigate and to find prey in the dark. I dropped the flare on the ground well away from Georgia and began unscrewing the suppressor on the P-90.
"Will! Marcy!"
I shouted, unable to keep the snarl out of my voice.
"They're about to go blind!"
Then I pointed the weapon up and off at an angle that I thought would send the rounds into the nearby lake, flicked the selector to single fire, and began methodically triggering rounds. The second clip had been loaded with standard rather than subsonic ammo, and without the suppressor to dampen the explosion of the propellant, the supersonic rounds roared out painfully loud. The flash at the muzzle lit the entire warehouse in strobes of white light. I didn't fire them in rhythm or any particular pattern. I had no idea how actual sonar worked in biological organisms, but I'd taken several nephews as a pack to see the Daredevil movie, and rhythmic sounds seemed to create a more ordered picture than random bursts of noise. As I worked my way through the 50-round magazine, I could all but hear Dresden's mockery, his voice edged with adrenaline, the words coming through a manic grin as I'd heard several times before.
"Murph, when you're reaching out to movie concepts that involve millions of dollars in special effects for your tactical battle plan, I think you could pretty safely take it as an indicator that you are badly out of your depth."
But as the last round left the gun, I heard one of the turtlenecks screaming in pain, a horrible cry that ended abruptly. And then the warehouse fell silent again, only to be invaded by another steady series of rhythmic clicks. And this time they were definitely getting closer. I unclipped the P-90 and set it aside. I had only two clips for the weapon, but my SIG came into my hand with a smooth familiarity of long practice, and I moved away from Georgia and the other prisoners around behind the empty cages that had been meant for Will and Marcy. I nearly screamed when I kicked a dead body and found the other turtleneck lying in a pool of viscous blood, apparently the other bad guy Will and Marcy had seen to.
Some instinct warned me I was in danger, and I dropped flat. Another sea urchin projectile streaked over me. A second struck a bar in the empty cage and slammed into its floor, acid chewing at the steel. Then there was a third whispering projectile that brushed away from me. A wolf began to scream in agony. Horrible, horrible high-pitched screams. Nothing had just pulled the same trick I had, shooting at me and enticing one of his other enemies into the open, as he did, then spinning to fire at an unexpected moment. Will or Marcy had just paid a horrible price for their aggression. I came to my knees with a cry of fury and flung my flare. It went high into the air, spinning, spreading red light wide and thin around the inside of the warehouse. I saw a massive black form ahead of me, turning, the tube of his projectile weapon swinging back toward me. The SIG was faster. I had already slid into a weaver stance, and I slammed out a trio of shots, swift, steady, and practiced, all aimed at the upper torso to avoid any chance of hitting one of the wolves. I know at least one of the shots scored a hit on nothing. The flare landed, still blazing. I saw the black outline of his silhouette twist in agony, then heard a quavering grunt escape him. He moved away from the flare and out of my vision. An instant later, I saw a wolf leap across the scarlet pool of light, and I started squeezing out more rounds from the SIG. I staggered them just as I had the shots from the P-90, hoping to blind nothing as the wolf attacked. The magazine emptied in a few seconds, though I hadn't meant to fire that many shots. The excitement of the fight was making it hard to stay level. I ejected the empty mag, slapped in a fresh one, and pulled a second flare from my tack vest, bringing it to hissing life as I started forward, my gun extended. I could hear nothing fighting with a wolf. His voice emanated from his huge chest, a basso growl of rage, every bit as angry and animalistic as the snarls of the wolf fighting him. I used the sound as my guide and rushed forward. The other wolf kept on screaming in agony, its shriek slowly changing and becoming more and more eerily human. The scarlet light of the flare fell across nothing and the wolf version of Will, just as nothing flung the wolf to the concrete floor with bone-jarring force. Will let out a shriek of pain, and bones popped and crackled, but he retained enough awareness to roll out of the way as nothing sent one huge foot stomping down at his skull. I started putting rounds into Nothing's chest from maybe 15 feet away. I was shooting one-handed and was hyped up on adrenaline. It wasn't an ideal state for marksmanship, but I wasn't trying for points on a target. This was instinct shooting, the kind of accuracy that comes only with endless hours of practice, with thousands and thousands of rounds sent downrange. It takes a lot of work to make that happen. I'd worked. I was using a 9mm weapon. The rounds were on the small side for real combat, and nothing was on the other end of the combat universe from small. He turned toward me, and I saw he no longer had the projectile tube, or two of the fingers on the hand that had been holding it. One of the wolves had tried for his throat and evidently had torn open the fine cloth of the sweater's neck, because I could see his gills flaring as he charged me. Shots struck home in his torso. I was aiming for the heart, which few people realize is fairly low in the chest, a couple of inches below the left nipple. I hit him with every shot, 6, 7, 8. It takes an attacker about 2 seconds to close a gap of 30 feet and get within range for a strike with a knife or fist. Nothing was about 5 feet closer than that. 8 shots, all of them hits, was damn solid combat shooting. It just wasn't enough. Nothing plowed into me like a runaway truck, sending me sprawling. We both hit the concrete. Pushing against him, I barely managed to keep his weight from coming down on my chest, so that it came down somewhere around my hips instead. He seized my right hand and squeezed. Pain. Tendons tearing, bones cracking. He shook his arm once, and my SIG went tumbling away. I didn't hesitate. I just doubled up, leaning toward him, and rammed the blazing end of the flare into the open flap of his gills. He screamed, louder than a human being could have, and both hands flew to his throat to clutch at the flare. I got a leg free and kicked him in the chin, hard, driving down with all the power of my leg behind a crushing heel. I heard something crack, and he screamed, flinching. I freed my other leg and scrambled away from him, clutching awkwardly at my right ankle with my left hand. Nothing tore the flare out, his pale eyes nearly luminous with rage, and came after me, roaring. I had never been more frightened in my life. I couldn't get to the damn holdout gun before he reached me, so I did the only thing I could. I ran, blind, into the dark.